It's Thursday, May 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama confronts a thorny issue as he arrives in Japan for the G7 summit.
They did not try very hard to rescue Gao Zhisheng out of China.
How China's government affects its critics overseas. Financial markets are up. Where do they go from here? And the perils of climbing the world's tallest mountain. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama is in Japan to attend the G7 summit of the world's wealthiest countries. Mr. Obama met with summit host Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe to discuss slow economic growth throughout the world's major economies, and Mr. Obama's visit on Friday to Hiroshima, the Japanese city where the United States dropped an atomic bomb in 1945, killing tens of thousands of Japanese and hastening the end of World War II.
Our visit to Hiroshima will honor all those who were lost in World War II and reaffirm our shared vision of a world without nuclear weapons, as well as highlight the extraordinary alliance that we have been able to forge.
Mr. Abe also told the president of his country's profound resentment over a former U.S. Marine's confessed involvement in the killing of a 20-year-old Japanese woman outside an American military base in Okinawa. Mr. Obama said the United States considers the crime inexcusable.
We did discuss the tragedy that took place in Okinawa, and I extended my sincerest condolences and deepest regrets.
President Obama arrived in Japan following a three-day official visit to Vietnam. Analyst Jonathan London of City University of Hong Kong tells VOA's Victor Beatty that visit represents a major step forward in bilateral relations and spoke of the potential effect of Mr. Obama's speech on human rights.
Well, I think one thing it does do is send a message to the Vietnamese people. You know, I happened to be at the speech, and I was impressed, as I think was the whole audience, by Obama's presentation. This message was extremely well received by the Vietnamese people, and in fact, the audience at the conference center was quite engaged, and his speech is being widely discussed in Vietnam. The text has been translated. It's available on video with subtitles over the internet. What Vietnam needs to move forward and develop a dynamic economy that is better governed and more innovative is precisely the kinds of transparency and respect for rights that not only Obama but, you know, many Vietnamese have been calling for. That doesn't mean that progress is likely, but I think it was a relief to people who want to see a safe, independent, prosperous Vietnam, but also one that lives up to the principles that are enshrined in its own constitution.
Jonathan London says Vietnam has been undergoing an evolution before the Obama visit toward a more dynamic, pluralistic society, even though its politics tend to lag behind. It's time for us now to check out what's trending online. The Taliban named a new leader this week after a U.S. drone strike killed Mullah Akhtar Mansour last Saturday. Our social media guru, G. Abby Lee, is here to tell us about social media reactions. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. The Taliban confirmed the death of their leader and selected one of his deputies to replace him on Wednesday. His name is Mullah Haibatullah Akhundzada. The New York Times was one of the first to share an article about it on Facebook, and its top comment is by a user named John. He wrote, "Wow, a leader dies and has been replaced already. Does this mean the Taliban works more efficiently than the U.S. Congress?" That sarcastic reply got nearly 250 likes so far. Many other people also commented on how swift the transition was and lamented the Taliban attacks will likely continue for some time.
Well, last weekend's drone strike happened along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. Were there any comments about that?
Absolutely. You know, some people strongly believe that the Pakistani government can do more to undermine the global terrorist groups, and that concern was certainly reflected on social media platforms.
Well, how about some of the comments from that region?
I've been following a reporter based in Afghanistan. His name is Habib Khan Totakil. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and on Twitter at Habib Khan T. One of his tweets reads like this: Afghan government warns new Taliban leader Mullavi Haibatullah to either talk peace or meet the fate of his predecessor.
I see. Okay, well, what else is trending online?
Again, U.S. politics. Presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump called Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, referring again to her partial Native American ancestry. Many people with that ancestry found that label to be quite offensive and definitely expressed that online. Jim, back to you.
Well, definitely an ongoing conversation, anything related to Donald Trump. Thanks for the wrap-up, G. And for more stories like this, you can follow us, if you like, at VOA_IE. We're also out there as at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Here are some of the top stories that are trending right now in Asia. Taliban IDs new leader and confirms Mansour death. Tight-fisted in Tokyo, Japan's economic conundrum. Human Rights Watch says Indonesian children endangered working in tobacco fields. In China, Taiwan's female leader is called extreme because she's single. And ex-South Korean soccer referees indicted over payments. You may find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our voanews.com website and also through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Chinese journalist and activist Su Yutong told a congressional commission this week that U.S. President Barack Obama has been weak in dealing with China's human rights issues. Su now lives in Germany and traveled to Washington to speak before the Congressional Executive Commission on China. The panel is exploring how the Chinese government's actions are affecting its critics overseas. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with Su at VOA Wednesday and asked her why she believes Obama has not been forceful on China's human rights situation. Su speaks through translator Rose Tong, who is a survivor of the 1989 Tiananmen Square crackdown.
I did criticize President Obama at yesterday's congressional hearing for being weak and compromising when facing human rights issues in China, especially in recent years. For example, the case of human rights lawyer Gao Zhisheng. Gao Zhisheng did request to come to the United States to be reunited with his wife and his daughter. But the U.S. government said Mr. Gao was not willing to leave China. They did not try very hard to rescue Gao Zhisheng out of China because they didn't want to. China's human rights conditions have worsened greatly in recent years, especially under Xi Jinping's regime. We can tell that in certain cases, President Obama only did something on the surface, on the face value, but nothing really concrete. For example, the sweeping crackdown on the human rights lawyers, the so-called 9th of July crackdown last year, and the persecution of the people who were involved in commemorating in the Tiananmen massacre or the participants of Tiananmen massacre. So compared with what the German government has been doing, the Obama administration hasn't done that much. This is not just my personal view. A lot of other people agree on this because many Chinese look up to America as the country that upholds the human rights, the value of democracy. But the Obama administration, President Obama, it seems have lost the basic principles.
How are some of the ways that you have dealt with that the Chinese government has affected people like you, you know, you and also people like you who are overseas Chinese. You're no longer living in mainland China, but is it, you know, is affecting you and your life?
I myself have been on the blacklist of the Chinese government. I cannot return to China. And it's the same case with many of my friends.
我在接受《纽约时报》的采访的时候，曾经，表示
，In an interview with the New York Times, I have said something like this: the Chinese government, their crackdown on overseas Chinese dissidents overseas, have been increased, especially on the newly arrivals, such as my friends. New York-based activist Bei Feng and German-based Chinese writer Chang Ping. Because a lot of newly arrived dissidents, they are very active on social media. They use the social media to spread the news of the human rights conditions in China. And also they work closely with the traditional media to expose the human rights abuses. And the Chinese government wouldn't like it. The usual tactics of crackdown on these Chinese dissidents overseas has been their usual tactic, which is not allowing them to go back to China to work. For example, those former student leaders of Tiananmen movement, Wang Dan and Wu Kaixi, they haven't been allowed back in China. So is the case with many other Tiananmen participants. But since Xi Jinping took power, they have upgraded their crackdown methods. Since Xi Jinping took power, they started to persecute the relatives left behind in China, the relatives of these dissidents overseas. So these relatives, family members of these dissidents, they constantly, they're subjected to harassment, interrogation, detention, and some of them have even been sentenced to jail terms.
Chinese journalist and activist Su Yu Tong speaking at VOA through translator Rose Tong. Recent tragedies in the quest to scale Mount Everest are reflected in a new documentary about the people who help climbers reach the top of the world. That's coming up in just a little bit on International Edition. But first, U.S. financial markets had a second day in a rally mode as they went up. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York to tell us why investors seem to be in a good mood.
It's been some pretty incredible action over the past 2 days. We're up over 50 points in the S&P 500. The Dow is on track for two straight consecutive days of triple-digit returns. And there's three main reasons to this. The first being Apple is at about $99.50 right now. That's quite a comeback when it was trading sub-90 just about a week ago. We're also seeing participation from the financial sector, which has been severely beaten down. Now that an interest rate hike seems to be more on the table in June. It, one, eliminates some uncertainty from the market, but financial stocks make money with higher interest rates because it allows them to grow their margins. So when we've been operating in historically low rates, that's one of the reasons why the banks have not been able to grow. So now that we've gotten more aggressive rhetoric about an interest rate hike, the financials have certainly caught some steam with that. Another sector that's lending to the strong performance in the Dow and S&P are the home builders. Toll Brothers reported a fabulous quarter. Their guidance looks pretty solid as well, but we also received really strong housing data on Tuesday. The housing data is almost a precursor for the bigger macroeconomic picture. So when you see strong housing data, that lends well to the bigger picture. A lot of these data points are what the Fed is dependent on. And, you know, that's why we're seeing a pretty strong market.
The Fed wanting to raise the interest rates ever so slightly, but in a very measured way. Mm-hmm. The market pretty much has kind of built this expectation in, correct?
Right, that's correct. And I also think it's like anything else. Anytime you talk a subject to death over and over again, the market almost becomes complacent or immune to it. And again, if rates were to move higher, that is a suggestion that the Fed thinks that the economy is growing and it's getting stronger. We're just about to touch new all-time highs. And I think what we're seeing right now is we've perhaps have established a new range in the S&P, and we'll see some of this choppy trade. We'll have some up days, we'll have some down days, but that's what makes averages, and this could perhaps be the new range that we're trading in right now.
Of course, investors do not like uncertainty, and some of that uncertainty has been removed. There's still a few things floating out there, like the Brexit situation, and oil has rebounded nicely.
I think we'll get more clarity once we get past the rate hike, if and when we do get one. Brexit, that vote is on June 23rd. So once we kind of get past the end of June, we'll have more clarity on the macro picture. I think for oil, we're going into the seasonal high demand going into summer driving. So if we see some drawdowns there, I think we can also get some more of a bounce in oil. Again, oil is so sensitive to geopolitical issues and any, you know, if we get any more disruptions, if we see any more disruptions in Nigeria, or, you know, God forbid we get a catastrophe like we saw in Alberta, Canada, which also took back some of the supply. It seems to be, with analysts I've spoken to, you know, that $45 to $50, perhaps $55 range seems to be appropriate right now. So if things continue going on the path that they're going, oil should be relatively stable here.
Always stable is the information we get from Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
All right. Thank you very much.
And be sure to follow Jill on Twitter. Her handle is @OptionsProfits. And you can follow our program, International Edition, at VOA_IE. While you're online, visit our website, voanews.com, and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the Internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website, Twitter, or Facebook page. Find out more by visiting us at our webpage at voanews.com and then click on Digital Frontier. Tell your story and share it with the world through VOA's Digital Frontier.
This is VOA's International Edition. At least 4 people have died on Mount Everest this week, 3 of them amateur climbers and 1 a Sherpa mountain guide. And he's not the first one. Dozens of Sherpas have lost their lives guiding foreigners to the summit of the world's tallest mountain since 1953, when British expeditioner Edmund Hillary and local Sherpa Tenzing Norgay made the first ascent on Everest. The son of that first Sherpa to reach the top is now slamming the mountain climbing industry for exploiting Sherpas who risk their lives for a pittance. VOA's Penelope Palou has more.
On April 18, 2014, filmmaker Jennifer Peedham of the documentary Sherpa captured the worst tragedy that has ever happened on Everest. 16 Sherpas, the native guides of Mount Everest, died in that avalanche. The film focuses on the dangers and hardship the Sherpas endure every climbing season for a fraction of the profit expedition associations and the Nepalese government make at their expense.
Roughing it on Mount Everest. Hot towels and tea in the morning.
And while the visitors are prepping for the climb in their spacious tents, the Sherpas pay their respects to the gods of the mountain, praying for a safe ascent while their families anxiously await their return. Doing anything at this altitude is risky and can be deadly, but lavish summit expeditions designed to make the climb less extreme are the very things that endanger the lives of climbers and Sherpas alike, says Norbu Tenzing Norgay.
My father said, I wish I had never climbed this mountain.
He is the son of Tenzing Norgay, the first Sherpa ever to climb Mount Everest.
Can we reduce that risk? Yes, you know, if people aren't carrying espresso machines and heaters and pads so that the clients can sleep comfortably. yes, you can reduce the risk.
The documentary highlights the inequity and the cultural rift between the Sherpas, who see the climb as a pilgrimage, and the Westerners as a challenge. Despite the dangers, the Sherpas depend on the expedition business. Each makes about $5,000 a season, while their farming counterparts make $700 a year. But that amount pales next to the $70,000 or $100,000 each climber pays for the trip of his dreams.
Good morning, Dai.
Good morning, Mount Everest.
The lion's share goes to the businesses and the government, says Norbu Tenzing Norgay.
The average Sherpa now gets $15,000 in insurance should something bad happen, and that's up, $5,000 since 2014. But if you go back a number of years, when somebody died on Everest, the average Sherpa was able to build a house, send the kids through school, and have a tea house. And these days, the insurance barely covers the cost of a funeral.
According to the documentary, the April 2014 avalanche was the last straw.
16 people dying at the same time, it's a huge, huge shock. When it started to sink in, the anger got distinctly pointed at the government. They feel that the government has always been benefiting off the labor of the Sherpas, the lives of the Sherpas, and never put anything back.
To try to get more control over their fate, many Sherpas are beginning to bypass climbing businesses to start their own expeditions. Their goal is to control the experience and keep themselves and climbers safe, if not comfortable, on a mountain they revere. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And be sure to visit voanews.com for the in-depth video goes along with Penelope's story. You've been listening to International Edition. In addition to our website, you can like us on Facebook at VOA Now, follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our thanks go out to Tracy Carter and engineer Carl Starling, who have climbed the summit with us today. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thank you so much for being with us, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Treasury Department has put in place sanctions against Libyan Speaker and President of the House of Representatives, Aguila Saleh Issa, for undermining the political transition in Libya. As a result of this designation, all property and interests in property of Mr. Issa that are within the jurisdiction of the United States or in the control of U.S. citizens are blocked, and Americans are generally prohibited from engaging in transactions with him. Aguila Saleh Issa is responsible for stalling political progress in Libya, and this action sends a clear message that the U.S. government will continue to target those who undermine the peace, security, and stability of Libya, said John Smith, acting director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control. We will continue to support Libya's government of national accord and its efforts to build a better and more stable future for the Libyan people. Mr. Issa repeatedly blocked votes by the House of Representatives needed to support Libya's political transition. In October 2015, Mr. Issa presided over a legislative session that was scheduled to hold a vote to endorse the Libyan political agreement and the Government of National Unity, or GNA. The session ended prematurely because Mr. Issa listed four new conditions for the legislature to approve the GNA, then departed, forestalling a vote. In early November 2015, the House of Representatives' vote was again postponed due to Mr. Issa's trip to Saudi Arabia, which appears to have been another deliberate act to prevent a vote on the Government of National Accord. Despite repeated Libyan calls to hold the vote, Mr. Issa began to travel again as part of his delay tactics. On January 25, 2016, the House finally voted to ratify the Libyan political agreement and endorse the Presidency Council. Since that time, however, Mr. Issa has prevented a vote on the Government of National Accord's cabinet, despite broad support for the cabinet by the membership of the House of Representatives, and in violation of the Libyan political agreement. The United States fully supports Libya's government of national accord and will not tolerate actions by individuals who undermine the political transition in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.